So whenever we are engaged in teaching and listening to some dharma, we must have the correct motivation. And with regard to the, as we usually say, the taking refuge in the three jewels distinguishes us from non-Buddhist, and then taking and cultivating the altruistic intention to become Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. In other words, cultivating bodhicitta distinguishes us from the lower paths. And therefore, from both the disciple, from both the teacher's side as well as the audience, we must have the correct motivation to have to listen to the teaching. So it doesn't make much. Wouldn't be great just to recite the verses of taking refuge in bodhicitta without understanding the meaning. Just parroting the verse would not help. So, of course, there are sayings in the text. It is said that by just reciting some mantra, you would be able to accomplish all your goals. Of course, it cannot. These kind of teachings cannot be taken literally. So the Buddha himself has said that the sages do not wash away the sins of sentient beings, nor do they take away the suffering of sentient beings, nor do they transpose their own realizations into others, but only by teaching the reality of truth. The Buddha helps sentient beings to lead to nirvana. And so, therefore, we have all these over 100 volumes of Ganjur, the words translated into Tibetan from Indian languages, and then there are over 220 volumes of the Kantenjur, and so which are all meant for studying the Dharma. So the purpose of the teaching of the Buddha is to make transformation within ourselves. And therefore, in order to make transformation, we need to know the structure of the teaching itself and how to go about with the practices. And therefore, just as the Buddha has said, by showing the truth, the Buddha leads sentient beings to nirvana. And therefore, we must understand the teaching of the Buddha and then make transformation on this mind that we have now by using our intelligence, so that through the development of intelligence and wisdom, we can overcome the distorted understandings, distorted views about things, and mere recitation of a mantra cannot help with this. So without understanding the meaning of the verse of taking refuge in bodhicitta, even if you may say it 100,000 times, of course you may gain some blessing, but it will not help in transforming yourself within. And therefore, the two verses which says, the first two lines refer to taking refuge, which says, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. And so all the religious traditions which have some philosophical background, the concept, do have some kind of a highest power according to their own tradition. And so now in order to have a very true sense of taking refuge in the gods, then in the theistic religions, what is said is that the God, the Creator, is almighty, and that is the purpose of this is to have single-pointed faith in the Creator. And so, with regard to Buddhism, the object of refuge according to the Chandrakirti, for those who aspire to liberation, nirvana, the three refuges are Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And so, with regards to nirvana, according to Buddhism, nirvana has to be attained within one's own mind stream, whereas in Jainism, they talk about nirvana as some kind of a place where you reach, a place which is said to be like in the shape of an umbrella put upside down. So, unique to Buddhism with regard to the nirvana is that, first of all, Buddhism teaches dependent origination of things, which is unique to Buddhism. And then, on the basis of this teaching, what we do is to overcome distorted views and distorted conceptions and misconceptions, because they create or they bring about suffering to us. And therefore, in order to be free from suffering, we need to overcome or eliminate this kind of misconception which sees reality otherwise. So by understanding dependent origination correctly, then we can see the reality of things, which is dependently origination. And therefore, the teaching of selflessness also comes because of the teaching of dependent origination. And so, on the basis of understanding selflessness, then Buddhism teaches nirvana. And therefore, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are the three refuges for those who aspire to liberation, as Chandrakirti says. So we're not talking about overcoming some temporary suffering or overcoming some kind of problems, or nor are we talking about mere attainment of some concentration leading to the form and formless realms in the next life. But here, in connection with the teaching on selflessness, then we have to understand nirvana. So what is the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha? So it is explained detailed in the Mahayana Uttara Tantra of Maitreya. So which is most extensive teaching on the three refuges. So in this text, it goes through the seven Vajra points. So first comes the Buddha, in accordance with the chronological order in which, within the context of one teaching of a Buddha, of a particular Buddha, first a Buddha appears. So Shakyamuni Buddha was born as Siddhartha. And then he saw all the different conditions of the samsara, and then he fled his royal kingdom, and then went through the six-year austerity practice. And then became enlightened. So, in order to, with the intention to teach the Four Noble Truths, and the Buddha then became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, and then gave teaching on the Four Noble Truths. With regard to this, the Four Noble Truths is taught three times, with regard, in connection with the nature, the function, and then the result of the. And so, through this teaching on the Four Noble Truths, Then the five human disciples were able to realize, gain realization, and then they realized the Dharma within themselves, and therefore they too became, or they also became Sangha. So that's the order in which, according to one teaching of a particular Buddha, how the order comes with Buddha, Dharma, and then Sangha. And therefore, since the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which are outside of us, they help us to tread the path leading to that kind of enlightenment which the Buddha has attained, and we take refuge in them, so they become our causal refuges. And so what we aim at is enlightenment. And so within enlightenment, there is enlightenment, Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattva or Mahayana enlightenment. Now here we are seeking enlightenment, the third kind of enlightenment, for the benefit of others. And not just for ourselves to become enlightened alone, for ourselves alone, but in order to help all sentient beings. And so for us, of course, even the Shravakas, arahats, and the Pratyeka Buddha arahats have not reached the ultimate ability to help others infinitely. And therefore, here when we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until I'm enlightened, that enlightenment has to be understood as the great enlightenment of Buddhahood. And therefore, in order to reach that, the Buddha also gave teaching on the Buddha nature. So Tathagata Garbha, because we have this, therefore we can attain the true path, and then journey along the path and the grounds of Bodhisattvas, and attain the different purified states. And then finally, ultimately, become fully enlightened by having overcome all the negativities within the mind. So the reason why we have not yet become enlightened is because of some certain veil that covers our mind. And therefore, although the mind's basic nature of the mind is clear light, therefore there is possibility. And this shows us the possibility that enlightenment is possible. And so once you overcome all the defilements that are within the mind, then you become enlightened. And therefore we have this Buddha nature. And so as long as there is some kind of distorted view or misconceptions, there's always an antidote to it, which can eliminate it. And so as long as we have this kind of misconception about the reality of things, there's always going to be an antidote that can overcome it. And therefore, when we are able to apply, or because when these misconceptions meet with their antidote, then there will be end to them. And so our ignorance, that the fact that we are ignorant is not because of the Buddha or because of our karma or anything like that, but this ignorance covers our mind, and therefore we are ignorant about it. And therefore, we need to know the reality of the mind itself and see the reality of the mind. And when you overcome all these defilements, that the distorted views or defilements, and through this antidote completely, then you attain enlightenment. So when we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I'm enlightened, you have to have some idea about what the Buddha is and the Dharma and the Sangha. And so first you need to study and hear teaching on them, And you should not leave at that alone, just thinking, oh, there was such and such as Buddha, such and such Dharma. But you need also to reflect on the teaching that you have received and then apply it, integrate these teachings within yourself and try to see some experience within yourself. And therefore, so by using reflection and thinking, critical thinking, then you will be able to cultivate wisdom or understanding coming that arises through reflection or thinking. And by seeing the reasons, then you will have reason-based faith. And even if you may be, and you may say that I take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, with this kind of firm conviction that arises in you through understanding what the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are, then it will be completely different from reciting the verse and reciting the verse hundreds of thousands of times without understanding it. So, with regard to the Buddha, the term in Tibetan is Sangye, which is a so how you become a Buddha is by overcoming all the defilements, by applying the antidote to them. Especially the obscuration to knowledge. And once you overcome this obscuration to knowledge completely, then you become enlightened, awakened, or you will be able to see everything, the diversity of things, as well as the final reality of things simultaneously without any obscuration. And that is the state when you become a Buddha. So you are saved from ignorance completely. So once you understand that there's a possibility of becoming enlightened, then you will have the aspiration to reach that goal. And then you will apply the teaching within yourself and go through the path. And by applying the path, by attaining the path within yourself, and as you go along the path, you reach the path of seeing, where you see the reality of things, the emptiness directly, and that's and then you still could go along, progress along the path and become enlightened. So first of all, you need to listen to the teachings and then reflect on the meaning of the teaching and then gain the experience and then in this way reach the path of seeing and become a Sangha member. And and then the next two lines say, by accumulations that I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And so what you're thinking is to help all sentient beings, to lead them to the goal of enlightenment. And therefore, right from this time on, you should apply the teaching within yourself so that you will reach that goal. And therefore, once you have generated this altruistic intention to become a Buddha, a bodhicitta within yourself, then what you also do is to engage in the bodhisattva practices, such as perfection of generosity, morality, and so forth. This is perfections. And so whatever merit you have collected, you are dedicating them to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. So you are dedicating whatever merit you have gained solely for the benefit of others and without any selfish motive. So So sometimes in this third line we say, by the accumulation of, by the merit I create. But instead of saying merit, if you just say, by the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha in order to become benefit sentient beings. And so in these lines, you come across the word I. I go for refuge, and then may I become a Buddha, and therefore... So during the first turning of the Wheel of Dharma, the teaching on Four Noble Truths, the Buddha has not... explicitly talked about the person who becomes enlightened and so forth. So when we come across these words, I, in this verse, you have to reflect on selflessness. And so, just as the Buddha says in certain sutra, that this the notion of I is a demonic mind, and it gives rise to all kinds of distorted views, and therefore there is no self. And then Nagarjuna says, I, or this self, is neither in the aggregates nor it is... They're different from the aggregates, and therefore neither the aggregates are in the neither the self is in the aggregates nor the aggregates are in the self, and therefore there is no self. And so you need to reflect on a lack of or absence of independent existence of an I. And with that, you should also dedicate whatever merit you gain through your practices, merits and so forth, for the benefit of other sentient beings. So, of course, you know this, but I wanted to remind you. So with this understanding, please say this verse. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. To the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by the accumulation I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Three times. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. To the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by the accumulations I create through the generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, by the accumulations I create through generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. This is a homage to the Buddha by Master Nagarjuna. Please open the text for the teaching, the three principal aspects of the path. So the Buddha gave the first sermon on the Four Noble Truths. So in the Pali canons, there are the three baskets. So whether it's a Pali tradition or the Sanskrit tradition, there's no teaching of the Buddha which doesn't come under the three pitakas. So with regard to Vinaya, the monastic discipline, the Pali tradition has Vinaya practice as well as we do have this. And so there are slight differences, of course, but basically we have the same kinds of practice. I have had many discussions with Pali scholars on Vinaya. And so with regard to the monastic discipline, it's almost
exactly the same. And then with regard to sutra teachings, there are, of course, some differences with regard to concentration practice. And then Abhidharma also, there is some difference. Within the Abhidharma, in the Pali tradition, there's teaching on the selflessness of persons, whereas in the Sanskrit tradition, we usually have the go through the four philosophical schools within Buddhism. So in order to train in the Mahayana path, with regard to the Mahayana conduct, we have the Chittamatra and Madhyamaka philosophical schools. So these two schools assert the selflessness of person and phenomena as well, on top of the teaching the selflessness of persons. So this is important, because when we grasp at a self, there is the self, clinging to a self in relation to oneself. And then similarly, there is also a grasping at the self of the things that we enjoy or we use, such as the body and so forth. So with regard with the Chittamatras, of course, say the mind is truly existent, and it doesn't help to say, even in from their point of view, to say that these things have no externality, to overcome this kind of misconception of holding on to true existence of the mind. And so Abhidharma is more extensive in the Sanskrit tradition. And so in the Sanskrit tradition, there is teaching on the selflessness of phenomena, not only selflessness of persons. And so there are differences in subtlety of the presentations of selflessness within the philosophical schools. All these philosophical schools, of course, were taught by the Buddha himself. And so with regard to the teaching on selflessness, establishing it through reasoning thoroughly, we have the tradition of Master Nagarjuna and his disciples. And then in the 8th century, the Tibetan Dharma Emperor, Tisong Detsen, whose mother was Chinese and father being Tibetan, he invited So before that, in the 7th century, the Songzhen Gampo lived, and he married two princesses from China and Nepal. And so these two queens brought a statue of Buddha age, which are enshrined in Jokang and and Ramuche in Lhasa. And so Tibetans already had this family relationship with China in those days, by those days. But then when it came to taking Dharma, the Buddhism, the Tibetan kings decided to take that not through a third country like China or others, but then took it directly from India. And so Tisong Detsen in the 8th century invited Master Chandrakshita from Nalanda, and then he also invited Guru Padmasambhava. So these three great personalities who are referred to in Tibetan as Ken Lop Chö Sum got together in Tibet, and then Tibet Buddhism was established firmly in Tibet. And so we follow the Nalanda tradition, and many of these the texts written by the Nalanda masters are first memorized by the Tibetan monks, and then we study them thoroughly, rigorously. And so it is this kind of tradition of studying Buddhism thoroughly through following the Nalanda master's writings is only extant in Tibetan tradition. So if we could also have a broad knowledge about the Buddhism and not just specific teachings, but following the Nalanda master's tradition, or Nalanda tradition, if we could have a very broad knowledge of the Dharma, it really helps. It won't be like a horse on which we put some kind of blinker and you see just one direction and not others. So the Buddhism that is spread, the Tibetan Buddhism, it's not just an ancient tradition, philosophical tradition, but also something which is relevant to today's world as well. We have to know this. So it's not enough just to say that Buddhism is very sacred, holy, but we need to study them and understand, to learn the teaching. So it's not only that the responsibility of studying the Dharma doesn't fall only on the monastics, and especially monastics who are monasteries where there are the study of philosophy, but everyone, whether you are layperson or monks and nuns, you should study because you will learn. There's great wisdom in studying this classic text. And so Tibetan Buddhism follows a pure Nalanda tradition. So there's within this tradition there is a great wisdom which has arisen from the great intellectual rigors of the great masters of Nalanda. And so all Tibetan Buddhist traditions, for them, it's very important to study the Nalanda tradition, which is like the main trunk of Buddhism that has spread in Tibet. And of course, the particular specific traditions themselves, of course, have certain features which are good, but without understanding this, the main trunk of the teaching, I mean, merely focusing on one's own particular specific practices may be difficult to give true, powerful experiences. So in Tibet, there is the tradition of three masters being referred to as the three Manjushris, or manifestations of Manjushri. Who are Sakya Pandita, and then Longchen Rabjampa at Tsongkhapa. So Master Tsongkhapa's writings are marvelous. You'll find, of course, teachings on the Tantra, such as the profound practices of Guhya Samaja and so forth, but not so much ritual text. So Master Tsongkhapa had many disciples, such as the eight great disciples, who are called the eight pure disciples, who are in his entourage. So in the earlier part of his life,
Shakyamuni.
And one of his disciples was Tsakovumbongawan Trangpa, who later went to the eastern part of Tibet and spread the Dharma and helped sentient beings there. And then he wrote a letter to Master Tsongkhapa to give him some Dharma instruction. And therefore, as Dharma instruction to Tsakovumbongawan Trangpa, Master Tsongkhapa wrote this text, the three principal aspects of the path. And in one of the miscellaneous texts written by Tsongkhapa, it is said that so he says that please follow this instruction that I've given you, and when I become enlightened, I will share the first, give the first share of my enlightened wisdom with you. And so he says that. Master Tsongkhapa says that he will guide the Tsakovumbo from life to life, and then when he becomes enlightened, he will give this share, the first share of his enlightened wisdom to Tsakovumbo. It's something great. So the text says Lam Tso, so Lam, the path. Now here the path refers to the spiritual path that we have to tread, which is for transformation of our mind. As Heart Sutra says, in mantra says, Gata Gate Gate, Vara Gate, Parasam Gate, Bodhisvaha, and so which refers to the fivefold path culminating in this Bodhi or enlightenment. And so you go through the paths of preparation, accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and then reach the path of no more learning. And so we all do not want suffering, but the root of suffering is within ourselves, not without. And so the source or the root of suffering is ignorance. And so suffering comes to us on the basis of our mind, which is untamed. And then these causes of suffering also must be found within the mind itself. And you cannot do operation, surgery to get rid of this suffering and its causes. If you do too many surgeries, then surgery could turn you dull. So what we need to do as human beings, we have this human intelligence. And using this intelligence, then we need to find the means to overcome the suffering. And so because of this intelligence, if we have too many preconceptions and all kinds of thoughts going on, and then if we turn ourselves more dull and so forth, sometimes people take to drugs in order to, or maybe suppress their suffering or something like that, but it will make the mind more dull in the end. And therefore, since suffering comes because of our mind, undisciplined mind, which in turn is rooted in ignorance, and therefore the ignorance has to be overcome by using our mind itself. So this human brain is something very special and unique. So of course, using other senses like eyes, nose, and ears, maybe the animals sometimes, like the elephant has much sharper kind of hearing power and sniffing power, smelling, and so forth. And so in terms of the sensory perceptions, it seems these animals have more powerful senses. So the animals have to survive their life using their senses. If there is some kind of a danger to their life or some enemy and so forth, they have to use their senses to detect the enemies. So, for example, a rat has to use its ears to hear its the enemy approaching. And therefore, biologically, they have some ability to avoid these sufferings by you, biologically equipped with it. So with regard, so for a rat, when there is a danger to its life, the only thing that it can do is to run away. So I have a story to tell. In Lhasa, one Yume monk who had done a three-month retreat on it's a great retreat on the Jigje Yamantaka. So one time he went to some family, some aristocratic family, to do some exorcism ritual. So he there, at that time, Sokwa Chodok was also there. He was very fond of Vaibhashika system, and so he was even nicknamed Vaibhashika, Sokwa, Mongolian Vaibhashika. So he was also there. So Sokpo Chodok was teaching grammar and so Tibetan grammar and so forth to aristocratic families. So Geshe Samdrupla was at one time doing a exorcism, suppressing his spirits, and Chodok just went to. So Geshe Chodok was told that Geshe Samdrupa was actually doing this ritual to suppress some evil spirit. But Sokpo Chodok said, leave alone suppressing any kind of doing exorcism to spirits. Geshe Samdrupa cannot even catch a mice. So we have this human intelligence with which we can create lots of problems. And so we can also use this same human intelligence to overcome, to uproot the suffering, the cause of suffering. And so the root of suffering is within the mind itself, and the antidote to it also comes from the mind. And this, the cause of suffering cannot be overcome within a certain short period of time. Months or weeks and so forth. You need to put effort for years and years and also for lifetime to lifetime. And so you need to develop and your knowledge further and further, and you gain more and more profound understanding of reality and so forth, and then overcome these negative fatigues that are within ourselves. So Buddhahood cannot be sought from outside, from somewhere else, but we have to know that Buddhahood can be attained from within this very mind. And so, therefore, sometimes there's also terminology such as the primordial Buddha is sought from within. So the main purpose of Buddhism is to attain nirvana, enlightenment, or liberation. Mere attainment of higher rebirth can be also done through the practice of non-Buddhist traditions as well. And then there are theistic religions which believe only in one life, and they do not believe in life after death. So their practice is love, compassion, and also contentment, and to help others and not harm others. And so they're also, by doing these practices of helping others and not harming them, and doing the other practices, I mean, they are creating causes for higher rebirth as well. And so the way to attain the liberation in Buddhism is by understanding selflessness. And so this is something unique to Buddhism. And within liberation, there is a liberation which is a mere freedom from all afflictive emotions. So, of course, there are different ways to understand liberation, but we should mainly, of course, there are many different interpretations, but we should mainly rely on Master Nagarjuna's text. And then Nagarjuna's disciples, such as Aryadeva, Buddhapalita, Chandrakirti, and then also Shandideva. And so these are the main masters that we should rely on, and we do not by referring to this them as the main masters to rely on. I'm not saying that they have they left a great legacy and that they have done so many things in the world, but what they have left are their texts, which show that we must rely on reason and logic in order to understand the teaching of the Buddha well, and not just based on blind faith. And so when it comes to using logic and reasoning thoroughly, these masters are really great. And there's nothing that you can actually counter their reasonings. And so when we use these reasonings that they have used, then we can see the different contradictions within certain traditions. And so these, when I refer to them as the main teachers, I'm saying that their writings are really called reliable, truly reliable in terms of... And so with regard to the two types of obscurations, of course, there are different interpretations. But as I just said, we need to rely on Master Nagarjuna and Aryadeva, his chief disciple. And these are the two original masters of the pioneers of the Madhyamaka tradition, and then following them, we have other Madhyamaka tradition, the Madhyamaka masters following different Madhyamaka traditions. And so, according to these masters, the Buddhahood is the state whereby you have overcome all defilements that are within one's mind, which means not only overcoming the afflictive emotions, but also the obscuration to knowledge completely. And so, when it comes to attaining liberation alone, we need to, first of all, develop renunciation, or the determination to be free from samsara. And then, in order to reach Buddhahood, we need bodhicitta. And so, even with regard to the cultivating bodhi, renunciation, or the determination to be free from samsara, we need to use our intelligence to find, to see the possibility of attaining nirvana. Of course, for some people, they may just follow blind faith, or mainly what we need is those beings with sharp faculty, using reason. And so nirvana is this total elimination of freedom from the suffering and its causes. And so by understanding emptiness, you should understand how this understanding or the wisdom realizing emptiness can lead you to overcome the defilements, ignorance, and so forth. And so for renunciation to true renunciation to arise within oneself, and one should also be helped, and the understanding of emptiness also helps. And then with regard to full enlightenment, Buddhahood, there is also there's twofold intention. First is the intention to help others, and then the second is the intention to reach that goal. And so if you understand that the suffering is something which is possible to be overcome, then you will find that possibility for oneself to and then when you see others suffering, then you will feel compassion towards them, having cultivated renunciation or this free the determination to be free from suffering. You also see the possibility for others to reach that goal as well, and therefore because they are overpowered by their ignorance and therefore causing themselves suffering and so forth, you will also have true genuine compassion towards others as well. And so when you really truly understand how it's possible to attain enlightenment, then you will have true determination to aspiration to reach that goal. So without really understanding what enlightenment is, you won't have true aspiration to attain enlightenment as such. And therefore, when with regard to enlightenment, reaching enlightenment, you have wisdom focusing. With wisdom, your mind focuses on enlightenment, and with compassion, your mind focuses on sentient beings, which is said in the in a commentary by Vimuktisena, Master Vimuktisena, in his commentary to the Abhisamaya Alamkara and 25,000 Pratyaparamita Sutra. So when you are helped by wisdom, and then you are able to see the reality and clearly, and otherwise you'll just be groping in the dark. But even if you may say you want to attain enlightenment and so forth, you without really understanding. And so these three, the renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view of are called the three principal aspects of the path. And so in the text, first Jetsongkhapa goes through renunciation and then bodhicitta, and then he goes into the teaching of selflessness, the correct view. So when it comes to cultivating bodhicitta is rooted in great compassion. So within the compassion, here we're talking about a compassion which can give rise to this special resolve to take the responsibility of liberating others by oneself. So in the process of cultivating bodhicitta, you also develop loving kindness towards sentient beings, holding them dear to you. And once you see these sentient beings whom you find to be dear to you, that they are suffering in samsara, with regard to some suffering, there are three types of suffering: the suffering of suffering, changeable suffering, and then the pervasive conditioning, existential suffering. And so with regard to the first two sufferings, of course, even animals first, are aware that of undesirable experiences as being painful. So we can see animals really mourning the death of someone in their herd, and And we too, of course, when some of our relatives and so forth are sick or something, we also become sad. And so this shows that we, even animals, do not want these painful experiences, the suffering of suffering. But then we also indulge in all kinds of negative actions because of not being aware that even those experiences which we usually consider to be called enjoyable and joyful and so forth, as being in the nature of suffering, they are not seeing that they are changeable suffering. So this kind of suffering is even seen as being unwanted even by non-Buddhist practitioners. So the suffering, the kind of suffering that we have to think about mainly is the third type of suffering, which is the existential conditioning, pervasive suffering. And so this is something which pervades everyone within samsara and so forth. Therefore, we have to cultivate renunciation based on the understanding of this kind of suffering. And so the understanding of emptiness helps to cultivate renunciation or the determination to be free from samsara, and also it helps us to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we need to think about the Buddha, what actually brings, what are the causes and conditions that bring about a Buddhahood. And so in order to have a very genuine sense of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we need the understanding of emptiness. So the teaching of the Buddha is primarily focused, given to beings with sharp faculty. So when we give teachings of the Buddha, we need to focus. I mean, we need to give teachings mainly focusing on these sharp the beings or with sharp faculty, not just those who are dull with it. And it would be difficult to give a full picture of Buddhism if we have to only focus on the dull, those who are dull in their wisdom and intelligence. So, with the help of the understanding of emptiness, we need to develop the renunciation, bodhicitta, and compassion. And so, when once you develop bodhicitta, you become someone on the path to path of accumulation. And in order to progress along the path, of course, there are other factors, but mainly you progress along from the path of accumulation to preparation, to seeing, to meditation, path of meditation, and by using your intelligence and wisdom. And so within the 10 bodhisattva grounds also, to pass from the first ground to the second and onwards, you need wisdom. And so the actual the factor which actually, counters our negativities is wisdom. And so the path of preparation of Mahayana, Bodhisattva path, is the second path, which comes through the which is attained when you have the experiential realization of emptiness. And then you go into the you progress further and reach the part of seeing, where you see emptiness directly, and then you still familiarize your mind with this direct experience of emptiness and enter into the path of meditation, and then finally become a Buddha. And so emptiness, when it's coupled with bodhicitta, you also help to yourself to overcome the obscuration to knowledge. Mere experience of emptiness, when it's coupled only with this sense of renunciation or the determination to be free from samsara, that will lead you to the mere nirvana. Overcoming all the negative emotions, and you are still left with the obscuration to knowledge. And therefore, to overcome this, you need bodhicitta coupled with the realization of emptiness. And so, to go through the text, Master Tsongkhapa, when he gave this instruction to Tsakho Ombong Awantrakpa, he says, "Homage to the most venerable teachers." So you need to go through the process of hearing, and then thinking, and then meditating on the path. And therefore, for this to happen, then you need a teacher, a spiritual master. Therefore, this homage is made. So verse number one. So it says, "I will explain here to the best of my ability the essential points of all scriptures of the conqueror." So in Tibetan, we have translations of the words of the Buddha, over 100 volumes of it, and then 220 plus volumes of Tengyur, the commentarial texts written by Indian masters. So this is the teaching that Master Tsongkhapa is giving here, is the essence of these texts. And then the path claimed by all excellent bodhisattvas, and the gateway for fortunate ones aspiring for liberation. And so, since a fortunate disciple needs to rely on this path that is taught here alone to reach Buddhahood, therefore it says the gateway to the fortunate ones aspiring for liberation. So bodhicitta is the main practice of all the bodhisattvas. And so these three lines can also be referred to as showing the thought of determination to be free from samsara and bodhicitta, and then also the realization of emptiness. So the gateway to fortunate ones aspiring for liberation can also be referred to showing emptiness. And so here, when the Master Tsongkhapa says, "I'll explain here that to the best of my ability," he also meant to say that he is showing the path to Buddhahood in very concisely, in few words. And then it says, "Those who are not attached to the joys of cyclic existence," so this cycle existence or samsara is this the five aggregates which come about through the force of karma and delusions. And so this is not something to be called to feel joy. And then it says, who strive to make meaningful this life of leisure and opportunity. And so having found this kind of precious human life with leisure and opportunities, if you can use it to serve other sentient beings. Therefore, it says to who strive to make meaningful this life. So here, with regard to making this life meaningful, there are different ways. If you aspire to reach nirvana alone, that is one way of making it meaningful, which is called just intermediate kind of meaning. And then if you dedicate it for full enlightenment of Buddhahood, then that's the best way to make it meaningful. And so in order to reach Buddhahood, of course, you need to know the complete path, which is unmistaken, and then the order of how you go about with the practices also should be unconfused. And so, therefore, it says, who plays their trust in the path that pleases the conquerors, oh, fortunate ones. Here is referring to such a person who understands the complete path leading to Buddhahood. Listen with an open heart, it says. So otherwise, therefore, you need to listen to such a teaching with this kind of attitude to make the most out of this kind of life of leisure and opportunity for the benefit of other sentient beings, not just for some inferior purposes. And so, having asked the disciples to listen, then Master Tsongkhapa says, without pure renunciation, there is no way to pacify the yearning for joys and fruits of samsara's ocean. Since craving for existence chains us thoroughly, first search for true renunciation. So here, the reference with the pure renunciation on means that you want to be free from all kinds of suffering. Mainly focusing on the existential pervasive suffering. So without such a pure renunciation, there is no way to pacify the yearning for the joys and fruits of samsara's oceans. So without seeing the pervasive existential suffering as being in the nature of suffering, merely by overcoming some kind of some degree of suffering or unpleasant experiences will not help. So there's the and then since craving for existence, the riches of the samsara, chains us thoroughly. So therefore this kind of a craving actually binds us in samsara. And therefore it says first search for true renunciation or the determination to be free from suffering. And so for the practice of cultivation of renunciation, Master Tsongkhapa uses the four ways of turning the mind away from samsara, or attachment. And so by meditating on the lower realms of existence, the suffering of lower realms of existence, meditating on the preciousness and the of this life, and also how transient it is, Master Tsongkhapa shows the path, practice of turning your mind away from attachment to this life, and then by showing the the infallibility of karma and these the faults of samsara, he shows us the path to the practice to turn our mind away from these pleasures of next life. And so, with regard to cultivating renunciation, this verse number 7 and 8, are very powerful for this. So because of our grasping at self of persons and the phenomena, then we create the causes for suffering, and therefore, although we do not want suffering, suffering befalls us. So it says that we are constantly swept away by the four powerful rivers. So I can't remember what are the four. So perhaps the four powerful rivers refer to the rivers of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And so our life begins with birth. And then there is suffering of sickness. And then there is suffering of aging. And then finally the suffering of death. So our life begins with the suffering of birth, and then ends with the suffering of death. And in between we have the suffering of aging and death, suffering of sickness. So that's how our life goes. So everyone on this earth, all human beings, go through these four sufferings. So when we look at others and ourselves, we all can see that we are all in the same boat. So although some people might look very, it might look that some people have no problem at all, but when we sit down and talk calmly and then talk, we'll find out how much suffering they have. And so these are something which are unavoidable because of our karma. And so it will not help us to try to overcome suffering, seeking the means to overcome them from outside. But we need to use our own mind. When we face suffering, if we could actually use that opportunity to and take the suffering on the path, and then we'll be able to help ourselves. And so all these misfortunes that we face will be like a blessing in disguise. And also we can use this opportunity of when we suffer for developing compassion and also special resolve to help, to take the responsibility of helping others out of suffering. And then you can also think about equalizing, exchange self and others, and meditate or cultivate bodhicitta, and then everything that all these misfortunes will be like blessing in disguise for you. And so Chekhova says that I have received the instruction on this seven-point mind training and applied this teaching within myself, and I have no regret even if I die today. And so, so these four types of sufferings are something that we have to go through. So it doesn't make sense to complain about them as such. So as long as we are born in this kind of life, there is all kinds of problems. When we have things, we are not satisfied. When we don't have it, we suffer. And then we can also see that even professors and people with power and name and knowledge and so forth do have problems. And then there is jealousy amongst the knowledgeable people with knowledge. And so, whatever we do in such kind of life, everything makes us suffer somehow if we are not able to use the opportunity. So it's a matter of our outlook on the things that we can maybe able to overcome the suffering. And otherwise, trying to find the antidote to suffering from outside will not help at all. And so these sufferings come from their own compatible causes, which are the karmas. As it says, they are bound, tightly bound by the fetters of karma, most difficult to escape. So nobody wants suffering. But we create causes for suffering, as Chandideva says. Although wishing to overcome suffering, they run after the causes of suffering. Although they want happiness, they wish happiness. The ignorance destroyed happiness, like destroying as if destroying an enemy. So far, whatever we have done, we have not been able to add to overcome suffering. So why is that so? It's because we're trapped inside the iron mesh of self-grasping. And so this is ignorance. Within ignorance, there is ignorance about the suffering cause and law of causality, and what we need to adopt and what needs to be discarded. We are ignorant about that. And which is ignorance about the law of karma. And so this in turn, this kind of ignorance in turn is brought about by ignorance about the true nature of things, self-grasping, and grasping at this kind of independent self is the source of all kinds of negative emotions in us. And therefore, we become attached to people, people and things that are attractive to us, and we averse those that are not attractive to us, that are unattractive to us. So when we become attached or averse, it's in relation to ourselves. You say, it's not attractive to me, it's not good for me, or it's unattractive to me, and so forth, and accordingly you have these emotions. And so, grasping at a true existence of the aggregates, the psychophysical aggregates, gives rise to grasping at the true existence of self. And therefore, this kind of ignorance envelops us, our mind. And so the text says that we are enveloped in this thick mist of ignorance. And therefore, we have this ignorance about the true nature of things. And therefore, except for while being sentient beings, with amongst the sentient beings, except for those Arya beings whose minds are totally absorbed in emptiness, the rest of the states of minds within sentient beings are said to be mistaken, because there is this appearance of true existence in things, and we also accordingly cling to them. And therefore, as called, it is said that this kind of ignorance about this self-grasping at the true existence of phenomena, like the aggregates and so forth, gives rise to grasping at the true existence of self. And so long as we keep these graspings as at the self and phenomena within ourselves, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas have nothing to do. They cannot do anything for us. And then it says we take birth within cyclic existence that has no end. And where there's endless torment, and where we are endlessly tormented by these three sufferings, and so what we have so far sought refuge in are the twofold: the grasping a true existence of things and self, and also the extreme self-centered attitude. And so as long as we are overpowered by these two, enslaved by these two, there's no way we can be out of suffering. And therefore, when you see how much suffering we undergo through the force of these two, then we can see how these are so bad. And so it says, by reflecting on my situation of suffering condition, such as causing condition, generate the supreme renunciation within oneself. Then, going back to verse number 5, it says, having habituated your mind in this way, when not even an instant of admiration arises for the riches of cyclic existence, and the thought aspiring for liberation arises day and night, at this point true renunciation has arisen. So when you think about this, how self-grasping and grasping at true existence and so forth are mistaken views, then and see that there is possibility to overcome them through an antidote, a realization of self and so forth, then you will be able to see the possibility to attain nirvana. And therefore, you will have a very genuine sense of wishing to reach nirvana as well. And that is true renunciation. And then next is about bodhicitta. So with regard to how you cultivate bodhicitta, it says, such renunciation too, if not sustained by pure awakening mind, will not become a cause of the perfect bliss of unexcelled enlightenment. And therefore, this determination to be free from suffering, which is brought about by true knowledge, real knowledge about the nirvana, without that kind of renunciation, your pure awakening will not become a cause for perfect bliss of unexcelled enlightenment. And so this unexalted enlightenment is a state whereby you are able to fulfill the twofold goals of oneself and others, which is to say the attainment of omniscient mind of Buddha. And therefore it says, O intelligent ones, generate the excellent awakening mind or bodhicitta. And then with regard to the method of cultivating bodhicitta, then these lines, verses 7 and 8, which I have already explained in connection with the renunciation, has to be used again, which says, here you are thinking about the sentient beings. They are constantly swept away by the four powerful rivers. They are bound tightly with fetters of karma most difficult to escape. They are trapped inside the iron mesh of self-grasping, and they are enveloped in the thick mist of ignorance. So when you think about the ignorance being so powerful, you will also be able to see that see, even the stains that are left by this ignorance and the affective emotions have to be overcome as well. When you think about liberation and omniscient state, and in order to help others, you also need to see the possibility for others to become enlightened, and you should also see that there is no way you can stay without helping others out of suffering and its causes, and even the stains left by these affective emotions. So with regard to cultivating bodhicitta, you should think about the equalizing practice of equalizing and exchanging self and others. So with regard to this practice, Nagarjuna mentions this in his Naratnavali. And also the Bodhicitta Vivarana by Maitreya Nagarjuna, and then the most extensive explanation of this is done in Chandideva's Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. And next comes the view of emptiness. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate nature, even if you gain familiarity with the renunciation awakening mind, you will not be able to cut the root of samsaric existence. Strive then in the means of realizing dependent origination. So with regard to the way things are, the how things exist, there is the the final nature of things, how things exist, so you should, in order to overcome all kinds of defilements, you need to overcome the you need to understand this final nature of how things exist. Please take the tea. So without wisdom realizing the ultimate nature, so within the knowledge, objects of knowledge, there is this ultimate nature to be understood, and also the diversities of things to be understood. So what what happens with us is we become attached to some things and averse others because of certain appearance of things, these things appearing as if they have some kind of an objective existence. So because of this, so if we were to try to criticize these two, the attachment and aversion, saying that you are causing us so much problems, they would perhaps tell us that you need to survive, and in order to survive, you need facilities and to overcome the obstacles. And so they may tell us that they are helping us in to overcome these obstacles that for our survival. So how would you live your life without being able to avert the obstacles to your livelihood, to your living, and create the conducive conditions for your survival? So do you think these two would say so? So attachment will tell us that I'm helping you because I see what is beautiful in things and people, and therefore bring you close to them. And anger or hatred may tell you that I'm helping you because you need those. You don't need the obstacles like enemies and so forth. So I try to avert them. And so in this way, they would tell us that they are helping us for our survival. But what happens here is when attachment and anger or aversion arises in us, there's also a sense of the whatever attractive thing appears to attachment, there is this exaggerated way of seeing the beauty in the thing. And also, when we averse something, I mean, there is this exaggerated way of looking at the object at which we are angry, and or we averse. So, a scientist whom I know said to me that when someone becomes angry at somebody, the person looks totally negative. The second person. But that negativity in the person whom you are angry at, 90% of it is 90% of it is our own mental projection. And so because of that, you can see how anger or hatred is totally distorted conception. And therefore, you have to see that it is really bad. So when we are attached at something, what happens is the thing looks absolutely attractive, and therefore we also cling to that, and then because of that we create all kinds of problems. And so, Master Nagarjuna, it is true that what Master Nagarjuna says, that our karmas and delusions are because of some inappropriate attention that happens to us towards things. So because of the inappropriate outlook on the thing, then we become attached or averse. It's not attachment is not just when we see something beautiful as beautiful, but and also aversion is not just seeing something unattractive or unwanted as being unwanted, but when we look at these two excessively being attractive or unwanted, exaggerating it, then they become attachment and aversion. So when these two emotions, attachment and anger, tell us that they are really helping us to survive our lives, but you have to what we need to call a reply, how we need to reply them is that you have to tell them that you are not helping us to survive, but survive for our survival, but you are actually seeing things wrongly. So the way these things, these two the emotions see things as having some kind of objective existence or not, is true or not? So as Chetamatra say, that the things which are attractive or unattractive look as being attractive and not attractive objectively, and then they say there's no such way of existence of these things objectively. And so the Chittamatras deny any objective existence in things. The external, although they reject the externality of things, whether attractive or unattractive, but they still say that the mind, which becomes attached or averse, has some truth or reality in it. And so, whereas the Savatantrika Madhyamakas would reject even the mind as having some true, any true existence. But then, although Savatantrika Madhyamakas do say that things do not truly exist truly, they still say that there's some objectivity in the things. And therefore, to destroy all kinds of objectification in things and self, and the Madhyamaka Prasangikas say that there's nothing whatever that objectively exists, even conventionally. And therefore, we come across the teaching in relation to how things appear, appearance and the reality of things, we have the true truths. As Master Nagarjuna says, all the teachings of the Buddha are based on the two truths. So we need to know the final reality of how things exist, and not satisfying only with the appearance. And therefore, when we check how things exist, then they do not have any independent existence, true existence, but there is this grasping at true existence. And therefore, this grasping at true existence is distorted view, and we can see this as an enemy. So it says, even if your familiarity with renunciation of awakening mind, then you will not be able to cut the root of samsaric existence. And Master Tsongkhapa here says, in order to overcome this kind of to uproot this samsara, you need to realize dependent origination. He doesn't say strive then in the means of realizing emptiness, but he says, he uses the term dependent origination, because dependent origination helps us to overcome both the extremes of nihilism and eternalism. It helps us to have the realization of both the dependence of things and emptiness of things. So this is specially emphasized here. Master Tsongkhapa especially emphasizes realizing dependent origination. So he actually sees a very profound meaning in this, and finds it very important to understand dependent origination to overcome our ignorance completely. So when, with respect to all phenomena of samsara and nirvana, you can see the causes and effects never deceive their laws, and when you dissolve the focus of objectification, you enter the path that pleases the Buddhas. So sometimes after having studied Madhyamaka texts, people seem to just, when it comes to really practicing the Madhyamaka view of emptiness, people seem to forget, leave those texts that have really studied aside and focus on some texts, short texts which are called 30 or guidance texts for guiding one to have to meditate on emptiness, the correct view. So, for example, for Gelugpas, if you consider the text commentaries by Master Tsongkhapa on Madhyamaka Avatara and Muddha Madhyamaka Karika, which you consider to be just a text for study and not for practice, that's not really right. So in Madhyamaka text, we come across the point of whether the true existence appears to our sensory perception or not. And these needs, to understand them, I mean, we need to study Madhyamaka text thoroughly. And so it's very important. So the ultimate proof for saying that things have no intrinsic existence is dependent origination, and not just to say that things cannot be found when you analyze and look for, search for them. And so, dependent origination, when you using the reasoning of dependent origination, of course, you can come to the conclusion of things having no intrinsic existence. But merely saying that things cannot be found when you search for them in themselves, it can, is something which even through the quantum physics we can understand, where they say that there's no objective existence in things. So sometimes when the people are more or less carried away by some kind of a true and independent existence in things, and when they actually try to look for the things within the objects, then when they're not able to find anything objectively, then they are kind of surprised. So in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, we find mentioned the Buddha says, goes through different topics, different subjects, and saying this is empty, and that is empty, and so forth. And then he concludes by saying that these are merely in name and designation. And therefore, when you are able to understand that things are merely nominally existent, you will be able to see that there is no objective existence in things, them, but they are merely labeled or designated. So it says, with respect to the old phenomenon of samsara, you can see the causes and effects never deceive their laws. And so for this to be true, for the law of cause and effect to be true, what we need to also understand is that things are dependent, contingent. So if things are not dependent, then for their existence, they do not need to depend or rely on any other factor. But that is not the case. And therefore, cause and effect, for example, can be understood to rely on one another. So if things do have some objective existence, then they would be independent existence, and which means that they are not dependent on any other factors. But because things are dependent on things are interdependent, therefore we can have cause and effect. And then when you dissolve the focus of objectification, through this kind of understanding of dependent origination, nothing can be, when you whatever you search for, they can nothing can be found to exist in the object itself, and therefore no focus of objectification is left, and you enter the path that pleases the Buddhas. So in one of the Tsongkhapa's texts, which is the life account of Dagdungu, ever crying Bodhisattva, there is some account of Tsongkhapa's called understanding of emptiness or dependent origin emptiness, where he says that although things cannot be found through analysis, but they can still be called accepted and called from the point of view of others or something like that. And then in his Golden Rosary commentary to Abhisamaya Alankara, also there is some tinge of that kind of understanding of selflessness, which is not the full understanding of emptiness. But then here Master Tsongkhapa says, as long as the two understandings of appearance, which is undeceiving dependent origination and emptiness devoid of all these theses, remain separate, you will not have realized the intent of the sage. So you may use different reasonings to prove that things have no intrinsic existence or true existence, such as the reasoning of lack of one and many and so forth, but these help you to see that things do not have any cannot be found when analyzed. But then, having said that, you have to resort to some other means to come to the conclusion that it's this empty of inherent existence. But dependent origination, using the reasoning of dependent origination, gives both the understanding or insight into how things are designated merely in name, and that they do not have any objective existence. However, when not in alteration but all at once, the instant you see that dependent origination is undeceiving, the entire object of grasping at certainty is dismantled, then your analysis of the view has fully matured or is complete. So with regard to this term, all at once, we have to still think about this term. So when you are very familiar with the fact that things do not have any true existence, that they are empty of an objective existence, and you are familiar with it, then when you see things, the objects of senses, and what happens is things do appear to have some objective existence. When you look at me, I will appear as objective existent to you, and when I look at you, this happens. But the Seventh Dalai Lama says that they do not have any basis and root for such existence. So earlier, because of your meditation on emptiness, you have seen that things do not have any true existence, objective existence at all, and therefore, when you see things just as they appear to have some objective existence, you'll be able to see how the things do not have such a way of existence. And you'll see, the Seventh Dalai Lama says then, you see the illusion-like nature of things. And so, in your meditation on emptiness, you should be absorbed in this emptiness, the absence of any objective existence. And then, when you come out of the meditation, you will be able to see how things are illusion-like. So, with regard to the entire object of grasping at certainty is dismantled. So there are different explanations of the object of grasping at certainty, according to different masters. So for us, when we look at things, they do appear to have some objective existence. But just as soon as this kind of appearance happens to you, you should be able to dismantle it by remembering that they do not have such a way of existence. And so someone who has realized emptiness will be able to see that because things are empty and conventionalities of things are possible, and because of the conventionalities, emptiness is not possible. So furthermore, when appearance dispels the extreme of existence and emptiness dispels the existence of non-existence, you understand how emptiness arises as cause and effect. You will never be captivated by views grasping at extremes. Once you have understood, as they are, the essentials of the three principal aspects of the path, O Son, seek solitude. And so for Master Tsongkhapa, the relationship between Master Tsongkhapa and this disciple, Tsogwampung Awan Thakpa, when they were so close to each other that Master Tsongkhapa calls him his son. And so when you do meditation on the path to enlightenment, you can say the foundation of all good qualities, and then say these three principal aspects of the path. So it would be good if you could also do a reflection on the whole structure of the path to enlightenment as well, having done these meditations on the Lamrim. And so seek solitude, and by enhancing your power of perseverance, swiftly accomplish your ultimate aim, it says. So solitude here can be referred to the physical solitude, being in some isolated place, and then isolating your mind from preoccupations with the pleasures of this life and so forth. So, of course, in Highest Yoga Tantra, we talk about achieving Buddhahood within one lifetime, this one body. But it's almost like the communist Chinese propaganda. The real practice are these things. And so this advice was given to the monk by the monk Losan Thakpa Pel to Ngawang Thakpa, a leading person of Tsogo region. So with this, we are finished with the teaching on the three principal aspects of the path. Next, the Jenang or White Thara. So this is a visionary teaching. So in the Nyingma teachings, there is the Kama, Dharma, and then the pure visionary teachings. So within the pure visions, there is visions that appear in Nyam, some kind of a simulated experience. And then there is also pure vision appearing to the senses. And so this, the pure vision that the fifth Dalai Lama had, is the second kind of pure vision. And so Jerembuchi Tsongkhapa also had pure visions of deities, and then the first Dalai Lama also, when he was in Changchen Hermitage, he had it's quite clear that he had pure visions of deities. And then the second Dalai Lama Yidden Gyatso also had, and then the third, the Sonam Gyatso, and Yendin Gyatso, third Dalai Lama also had, and Yendin Gyatso, the fourth Dalai Lama, I don't know, and then the fifth Dalai Lama had visions, pure visions. So perhaps my predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, also had pure visions of deities. So of all the Dalai Lamas until so far, the only one who has no pure visions, not even a good dream, is me. So I always tell this story that of all the Dalai Lamas, I am the only one who has no vision, no pure visions, but I am the most popular, most famous Dalai Lama. So this is also thanks to the oppression of the communist China. So I have received teaching on the three principles from Dada Rinpoche. I can't remember, but I have received it from Ling Rinpoche, my senior tutor, the late senior tutor, and also Tijang Rinpoche. And then I have received the pure visionary sealed visionary teachings of the fifth Dalai Lama from my guru Dada Rinpoche. And I have had indications that I have some connection with this teaching during those days. So with regard to first, I want to explain about talk about Dagnang, the pure visions. So in Jerembuchi's Jetsongkhapa's secret biography, as his concentration grew stronger and more powerful, then he was able to have vision of Vajrabhairava Yamantaka. So of course, Jerembuchi had visions of deities since he was a child. But as his concentration of the combination of the shamatha and vipassana grew stronger and stronger, then he was able to have the vision of Vajrabhairava. So what this shows is that although Jerembuchi had visions of different deities, but whether you can have the visions of deities or not depends on your perception as well. As your ordinary clinging and ordinary perception of things diminish, then pure perception grows, then you can have pure visions. So first, it begins with a nyam, some kind of simulated experience, and then you will have visions of the deities in your mind, and then you will have visions in with your senses, sensory perception. And so in the sutra, it says sometimes all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas being in one called single atom. So for this, of course, there has to be the three secrets of the body, mind, and speech of a Buddha being of one taste. And so you have to reach that kind of attainment. And as you train on the path, as a practitioner, as a trainee, you need to have the create the courses for such attainment. And for that, you need to have the basic course for the path to realize. And therefore, we have the mind and the wind energy, the energy being of one called nature, of one taste. So visions are possible. Sometimes people say, I don't believe in these pure visions. Finally, it comes down to saying that I don't really trust. But it is possible to have the pure visions if you really give thought to these different practices. And so called the sealed visionary teachings of the fifth Dalai Lama has become like the main teachings of the Dalai Lamas. And so in order to practice Tantra, you need to first see the possibility of Nirvana and omniscient state of Buddhahood by understanding the emptiness. So without understanding of emptiness, it's very difficult for you to do Jaya Yoga practice. So without really understanding emptiness, if you say, I am a deity, just like that, it's this kind of thought, it's distorted outlook or misconception. So, of course, Jaya Yoga practice is done in imagination in the beginning, but you have to see the purpose, the benefit of doing this kind of practice. It doesn't help to overcome your thirst or hunger. If you just think that you had really nice, excellent food without really taking the food, I mean, would it really help your hunger? No. So you need to develop a very stable concentration. So even the non-Buddhist practitioners do visualize themselves as deities as well. So your visualization of yourself as a deity, if it doesn't help to overcome the grasping at true existence, then it doesn't really do the purpose for doing our tantric practice. So therefore, you need to meditate on emptiness, and from within the state of emptiness, you have to arise into a deity. And so at this point, of course, it's just in imagination that you go through this process of transforming into a deity. So the resultant state is that you become fully enlightened and with all the resources and so forth of a Buddha and the mandala and so forth. But in order that your deity yoga practice does not actually reinforce your grasping at true existence, you need to meditate on emptiness and therefore dissolve everything into emptiness and then arise into emptiness. And then in the lower tantras, we talk about the non-duality of the profound and the clarity when you do the Jaya Yoga practice. So it has to come from within the meditation on emptiness. And so here I have generated the three deities. Three deities in the altar, and also generated myself into the three deities with the central deity, the white Tara. So then now we are going through the Dharma offering for driving away the obstacles. So of course I don't have any realizations, but So if you think about the one taste of the body, speech, and mind of a body, body, mind, and speech of a Buddha, you don't need to think about inviting the Buddha here, or it's not the case that the Buddhas would come here if you invite them, and they won't come here if you don't. Because the mind, body, speech of the Buddha is of one taste. And so wherever the mind is, the body is, and so forth. And so, so the obstacles or interfering beings are sent away with the offering of dharma. And then, having sent these away, Vajra fence is created around this place, and next we make mandala offering. So you imagine the Lama to be in the form of the three deities. Please repeat this. Lama Rinchenta, Dojin Shatanat, Kovale Dutarim, Tiyuna Yijigitu, Tuwe Navanam Ratu. So this is making request to the Lama. So in the space before you, imagine the Buddha surrounded by the Master Nagarjuna and so forth, and also great bodhisattvas such as Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and so forth, and also all the Buddhas and bodhisattvas surrounding them. And particularly here, imagine all the lineage lamas, beginning with the fifth Dalai Lama, and down to Master Thathak Rinpoche. And so with this imagination, you'll go through these lines, repeating them. So I go for refuge to the rituals, which I have explained. And then you say, I confess individually all negative misdeeds. So because of our clinging to clinging to the true existence and things, just as they appear to us, we have created all kinds of negative actions due to selfish motive, because of being overpowered with selfishness. And so we have created all kinds of negative karmas with our body, speech, and mind. And so we need to confess all of them. And then next is, I rejoice in the merits of all beings. And so here, the beings refer to five types of beings: the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas who are near approaching Buddhahood due to their practice of bodhicitta and the understanding of emptiness, and also rejoicing in the merits of oneself and other ordinary beings, even the slight of love and affection that animals have. All all these good things that sentient beings have done, sentient beings and Buddhas have done, you rejoice in them, and then you say, I take to my heart the Buddhahood. So Buddha here could refer to the form body, and then enlightenment to the Dhammakaya within the Buddha. And so what this means is that I will that you will you admire or aspire to reach Buddhahood. And then next comes, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha Dharma and the Supreme Assembly. And so without being able to attain your own goal, the final goal, there's no way you can help others infinitely. And so self-cherishing attitude actually ruins us. And therefore, if you cherish others, you will be able to fulfill your own goal as well. As Jerem Boche says, that although you think of helping others, you think of helping others, you are able to fulfill your goal, your own self-interest as byproduct. And then says, I do so to attain an enlightened mind in order to fulfill the aims of myself and others. I shall develop a supreme enlightened motive, and towards all sentient beings, my invited guests. So you invite all sentient beings to the feast of enlightenment, and so which means to lead them to liberation and omniscient states. And I shall act with supreme enlightened conduct. And then may I become a Buddha to benefit all. And so with the aspiration, aspiring bodhicitta as the basis, then you also take the bodhisattva vows and say that you are going to engage in the bodhisattva practices for the benefit of all sentient beings. So then here you take refuge, and then you go through the confession, rejoice, and so forth. And then you say, and I do so to attain enlightenment in order to fulfill the aims of myself and others. And so you are you're generating aspiring bodhicitta, and then after that is the venturing or engaging bodhicitta. I shall develop the supreme enlightened motive, and towards sentient beings, my invited guests, I shall act with supreme enlightenment conduct. And so have this courage to cultivate bodhicitta within yourself for the benefit of all sentient beings, and say these lines, repeat these lines. Please kneel on your right knee. So perhaps we should repeat this. Whatever slight positive potential I may have created by paying homage, offering and acknowledging my faults, and rejoicing and requesting the Buddha stay and teach, I now dedicate all this for full awakening. Next is generating bodhicitta and taking bodhisattva vows. I go for refuge to the three jewels. I confess individually all my misdeeds. I rejoice in the merits of my beings. I take hold of my Buddhahood. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and I do so to attain enlightened mind. In order to fulfill the aims of myself and others, I develop the supreme enlightened motive, and towards all sentient beings, my inviting, I shall act with supreme enlightened conduct. May I become a Buddha to benefit all. So repeat it for a second time. I go for refuge to three jewels. I confess individually all my misdeeds. I rejoice in the merits of all beings. I take hold of with my mind's perfect state of Buddha. I go for refuge to the enlightened, to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I do so to attain enlightened mind. In order to fulfill the aims of myself and others, I shall develop a supreme enlightened motive, and towards all sentient beings, my invited guests, I shall act with supreme night, and may I become a Buddha to benefit all. And so at the end of this third repetition now, those who have taken Bodhisattva vows before, you should have this very strong urge to attain Buddhahood, to practice the Bodhisattva practices, to engage in the Bodhisattva practices. So those who have not taken vows before, you can make this pledge. I go for refuge to the rituals, I confess individual all my misdeeds, I rejoice in the merits of all beings, I take hold with my mind the perfect state of Buddhahood, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and I do so to attain enlightened mind in order to fulfill my aims of myself and others. I shall develop supreme enlightened motive, and towards all sentient beings my invited guests, I shall act with supreme enlightened conduct. May I become a Buddha to benefit all. As long as space remains, repeat this, as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Today my life has borne fruit. My life has become meaningful. Now come what may, I shall act in accordance with this excellent lineage without tarnishing. Please repeat this, Lama Rinpoche. This is a unique Duma Yimbe. Shiva Jigwa. Sabwe Tamje Selne. Jizun Jomden Dama. Dama Kamo. Jishikolo. Sejima. Nongorki. Nongorki. Batsatoso. So you have Nongorki. Jesu Nawa. Nongorki. Jesu Nawa. Sijin Ishikolo, Zongolgi, Jizukolo. So you requested to give the Jenang or the permission to practice do your practice on the Tara, white Tara, to avert all untimely death. So next is setting the basis for receiving this permission initiation. So those who have not received any kind of initiation, and even Kriya Tara, initiation of any Kriya Tara mandala deities, you can imagine Tara on your crown. Those who have received in the real initiations before, you may transform. Imagine yourself transforming into white Tara with the two deities. And so, when the Buddha gave teaching on the Four Noble Truths, at the end he said, "When you think about." When you think about how things exist, he said that there's nothing, no suffering to be overcome, no causes of suffering to be abandoned, and then no cessation to be actualized, and no path to be cultivated. So what this means is that things do not have any arising or cessation and so forth independently. And so, as the sutra says, whatever arises through conditions do not have arising. It has no nature of arising. But for us, things appear to have some objective existence. If things exist objectively, then we should be able to find them when we search for their identity. And therefore, since they cannot be found, what it shows is that we can be sure that they do not exist the way they appear to us. And so how do the things exist? Is by way of designation. But of course, even our distorted views do label things, but those do not exist either. And so things have to exist in conventional terms. And so, since they do not have any objective existence, they are merely in name. And but the name itself, when you try to search for it, you cannot find it under analysis. And therefore, you, what you have to do is you have to destroy all kinds of objectifications in things and events, names, and so forth. And so when you search, when you do this kind of critical analysis, searching for the identity of things, nothing can be found. So what this doesn't mean that things do not exist at all, but it means that they do not have objective existence. So in dependence on many different factors, we label and designate things, and therefore remember that things do not have any objective existence, that they are merely designated, and therefore think that you, as a person, when you think about your I, you think that this I is cannot be found under analysis, but it's designated, merely designated. So many philosophical traditions, even up to the masters of Savatantrika Madhyamakas, do say that a person, the final identity of a person is the sixth consciousness. But Nagarjuna says, if the person is not the consciousness and not all other elements, the constituent elements in us, then what is a person? So, of course, so when you think about the nature of the mind itself, it does not have any independent existence. So if the person were to exist from amongst the five aggregates, then you would have to be it would have to be posited on the consciousness itself. But when you look for the person within the consciousness itself, you will not be able to find it. And therefore, in Heart Sutra, it says even the five aggregates also are empty of inherent existence. And therefore, because things are dependently designated, therefore, they do not have any independent objective existence. This appearance of independent existence is there, and we cling to them as because of some distorted views. So we are not saying that things do not exist, but they do exist by way of designation. So things are devoid of any eternality or permanence because they are empty, and because they are designated, they are not called non-existent. And so these two extreme views are overcome through the understanding of emptiness and designation. And therefore, you need to dissolve this ordinary appearance, ordinary perception, and absorb, your mind should absorb in emptiness. And so this, from within this emptiness arises a thumb syllable, white in color, and that in turn transforms in the place where you are into this yourself as white Thara. To her right, to your right, to your left is Sayamatara. And then to your right is Ekajati. So on the crown, throat, and heart of these three deities, imagine Om are Hum syllables each. So in this heart of the central deity, at her heart, imagine this eight-spoked wheel, at the center of which is a thumb syllable. And then on the eight spokes, imagine Tare, Tutare, Ture, Swaha. And on the Sayamatara's heart, imagine Om Tare Tutare Ture, Mama Yupun Yana Putin Kure Swaha. So imagine white wheel with nectar falling, raining on you, and thereby going into your heart and filling of your body, and then receiving the blessing of immortality. And from the forehead of the central deity, from the Om syllable at the forehead, imagine the white rays of light coming forth, and these rays of light from the three deities come forth to you and dissolve into you through the forehead. Then from the R syllable, imagine red taras with a hook and lasso in their hands coming forth. And then from the two deities on the sides, rays of light from their throat, R syllable from their at their throat, come forth and dissolves into you. So all the red taras and the red light come forth and dissolves into you, thereby blessing you. And then from the Hum syllable, blue taras come forth. And also from the two side deities at the on the two sides, from their heart also rays of light come forth, blue rays of light, and your and they dissolve into you at the heart and bless your heart, purifying your negativities collected through your mind. And from the navel, Yellow Taras come forth, and also from the navel of the two deities on the sides. They dissolve into you at the navel and purify all the negativities that you have collected through your actions and behaviors. And you are blessed with the blessings of the Tara. So from the free syllable at the secret place of Vaitara, comes forth green Tara, and then from the secret places of the two deities on the sides, green light comes forth, and then they purify your negativities, and you are blessed with the fearlessness to overcome the eight kinds of fears or fearful states. So from the heart of the master and also the deity in the front in the altar comes the chains of the mantra, and they go down into the from the mouth of the disciples and go into your heart. Please repeat. Om tare tu tare ture mama ayu puni jana putun kuru soha. Om tare tu tare ture mama ayu puni jana putun kuru soha. Om tare tu tare ture mama ayu puni jana putun kuru soha. Let's say the Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Suri Soha, one round of mala. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha, 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 Om Tare Tu Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha, 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 Om Tare Tu Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha, 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 Om Dare to the other song, 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 dare to the other song. Dar 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 som 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 dar 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 Om Dar 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 Som 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 Dar Dar So imagine from this, the green Tara comes, from her heart comes this mantra. Please repeat. And then from the right deity, Brikuti, imagine this mantra comes. Please repeat this. Om Brim Soha. Om Arya Bim Kuti Soha. Om Brim Soha. Om Arya Bim Kuti Soha. Om Brim Soha. Om Arya Bim Kuti Soha. Please repeat this. Please repeat this. Love and consciousness. I by this name, from now on, until I reach the essence of enlightenment, I will take the three Tara deities as my personal meditation deity. I'll take or hold these three deities, the three Taras, as my meditation deity until I reach enlightenment. So this is stabilizing the blessings of the three Taras that you have received. So given a medicinal pills and also nectar. So may you live 100 years. So you're given the seven royal emblems, blessing you to have the attainment of Chakravartin King, merit equal to the Chakravartin King. And then you also imagine that you're given the eight auspicious symbols or substances. So with this, the fifth Dalai Lama's visionary teaching, in which there are 25 sets of teachings, so you have received the jenang of the three taras. Please repeat this. Please make mandala offering. So let's say the 21 Tara praise. Number
So for those people who are staying in Dharamsala, living in Dharamsala, I'm leaving day after tomorrow. I'll be in Delhi meeting people. And, so, and then I'll be in South India giving the remaining teaching on Lamrim. And so for about 2 months, I'll be away. So see you after 2 months. And take care.